Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme.
Can you provide opportunities for the local community to engage, and can you provide resources for them that are things that are missing from their own communities in order to welcome them in? What are the gestures?
What role do private developers play in changing public spaces in our cities? This week, we're going to gatecrash a visit to London by a group of powerful city makers. They were in town with the International Council of the Van Allen Institute, visiting, learning, and passing judgment on some headline-grabbing projects in the city. And we also lured some of them into our studios here at Midori House. All that and more coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's programme. And we're going to start with a simple, or maybe not so simple, question. Should private developers have access to public money and land so that they can build new neighbourhoods and public spaces? Well, it's a debate that's been in the spotlight recently, courtesy of the criticism surrounding the opening of New York City's Hudson Yards, a $25 billion project on the site of what was one of Manhattan's last undeveloped pieces of land. Here, developers were accused of using public funds to help finance the creation of a neighbourhood that really only caters to the city's elite. By comparison, London's King's Cross redevelopment, a plot of land of a similar size, has been much better received. It's used land purchased from the authorities to deliver a new neighbourhood with lively and welcoming public spaces. It's home to a university, affordable housing, schools, a public sports field, and a host of architecturally kind of significant buildings. Although even here, there have been some tough critics with questions that they want answered. Well, to put all of this in perspective, I've been joined in the studio by three guests. Monica von Schmalensee, a senior partner and architect at White Architecture, based in Sweden. Jared Della Valle, a New York City-based developer and co-founder of Alloy Development, which made a name for itself with work in Brooklyn, and he's also Van Allen's board chair. And finally, Alfredo Caraballo, a Venezuelan-born architect based in London, where he is a partner of Allies and Morrison, a big mapper and creator and planner of city projects.
Jared, maybe I can start with you a really kind of basic question. What have you been doing here over the last few days? This isn't for your company to check up on. You tell us why you've been here in London.
Yeah, I'm with Van Allen Institute, and Van Allen Institute is a not-for-profit organization that studies the impact of design on cities and what its potential is to impact people, right? The human condition. We spent the last couple of days visiting all of these fantastic new developments, right, between King's Cross and Olympic Village to consider the development role in the private sector in public development.
Now, Alfredo, you're all at the top of your game. Why would you take time out from your company to go around and see what rivals have been doing, what other companies have been doing? What's the benefit for you? I presume you're exposed to many of these projects in many different ways. So what's the gain for you teaming up with your colleagues here today and stomping across the city, seeing these projects?
Well, two things. Well, to start with, we have been involved in several of these projects ourselves in our practice at Allies Morrison. We were master planners of King's Cross and also were involved in the Olympics. But probably goes back to our involvement with the Van Allen Institute, that in a sense we want to put these projects and what is happening in London that is becoming a sort of a one of a place to look at in relation to urban regeneration, and then how you can put the experience and placemaking that is happening in London in a sort of a wider context, and how you can analyze development models, like analyze then the role of a private sector and the tension between the private sector and public sector and so on. And the opportunity then to have people that are coming from different parts of the world that are united by the same expertise, because most of our are, all of our are in the architects, developers, engineers. So we have a sort of a shared disciplines, if you like, allow us to have a sort of a critical debate about these projects and about what's happening in London and how that can influence back all different places. So it's a really, really interesting opportunity to put this project in context.
Now, for our listeners, Monica, I guess some of these questions come up in a slightly different format. It's great that the professionals get to see these projects, but the questions, I guess, are in our audience's minds are these projects good for me? You know, am I welcome in these projects? We see a lot of debate in our newspapers and on the air about, are some of these developments pretend public places? And then we see a lot of concern about, you know, looks great, amazing project, and it claims to have, for example, some affordable living tacked into it. But is it really for the community, and who in the end benefits it? If it's a private development, is it the end for shareholders, the ultimate top of the tree? And who are these things for? Those questions, I know that they touch the work that all of you do, but and I know from speaking to you before that they are top of your mind. But were these some of these more human questions important as you went around the city over the last few days?
Absolutely. And I think altogether, I would say this is all about people. And we were talking a lot about for whom, actually. And even so, our trips recently has been around the public realm and the affordability, but also the accessibility for whom and how, and also within community engagement. What was most interesting here, though, since we went to King's Cross as well as the Olympics, is the scale of these two projects. And even so, this afternoon we have been discussing together with the panel and together with a lot of people here from London as well, also about the boundaries and the inside out and how do we really have this engagement from the community and what's driven really the development and also what's in it for common people. But overall, I think it has been extremely interesting to understand, besides finance and besides politics and the community engagement, what's the essence of what people really want to have, like such as culture and places to be and also to be feel safe, but the scale of everything. So I think at the end, we started up by looking at the design and the how everything was planned and how it was organized. But we ended up to talk more about those things, about accessibility and affordability a lot, actually.
Well, for listeners, you know, the King's Cross development was led by Arjun. It's an amazing project. So if you don't know London, King's Cross, behind it had all these old railway yards and warehouses that had been neglected and abandoned over time. It was a place where rave clubs happened. There was prostitution, there was drugs dealing, but there was other important life going on there as well. The redevelopment has been, I think, regarded by most Londoners as a reasonable success. It feels like a part of London that people go through and use. Now, Jared, when you went to see that, what do you think are the things that they potentially got right in this mix, both of, you know, the design side and in making it a place that you feel you should go to, that you feel some attachment to?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was actually really legible. The master plan part was really legible, which is the spacing between the buildings and the kind of intimacy of spacing between the buildings and the kind of very careful calibration of the buildings to one another was actually both perfectly unnoticeable in a way, but if you're paying attention and if you understand the built environment, really noticeable in how well calibrated it was. In addition, the kind of edges and the surfaces, the hardscape that you sort of walk on in the streets and the thought and intention that went into the planning of that was also fairly sophisticated. Both a true guiding light, you noticed people interacting in different ways in different contexts based on something as simple as pattern, but you also really understood the thought and intention that went into the materiality and the choices that were made throughout, both from an enduring perspective, but also in a historical context of how London feels, right? It was in that way, it was exceptionally successful.
They have like amazing park benches through to the planting, through to the use of old materials like granite blocks and things. Just tell me, when you talk about the spacing of the buildings, that this is something we should unpack for listeners. When I go there, some of those buildings, the first part of it is really nice. They're quite snug and close. There's trails of greenery throughout. Is this the kind of thing you think we need to think about more, when it doesn't become a wind-blown kind of office block area, that there is this intimacy in the built environment?
Yeah, I think it forces people together to a degree in a really unusual way, right? I think in a lot of contemporary planning, absent a context like where this is in London, where everything is much more narrow in a historical sense, zoning in general and planning rules sort of force buildings further apart than they exist in this place. And it's really noticeable. And I think it's because of the way that people interact with each other and the proximity. Even in an unnoticeable way. It's just you're passing other people. And I think the calibration of green spaces and how they treated open spaces to draw your eye through, where vistas happened in between buildings, it was really clear. And the variety of architecture that happened also created a series of clear viewpoints and vistas where you're looking in between both historic buildings, which are a really critical part of the success of that plan, is the curatorial nature of how big masses were up against historic structures is one of the other huge successes there.
Alfredo, they also have the benefit, they have the Central St. Martin's School there, so they have lots of young people, students coming through who stop it being a Canary Wharf where often you feel that the demographic is very, very tight and narrow and everyone kind of looks the same. They also have some good physical features. They adopted the, you know, there's a canal that runs through it. But apart from that, what was your takeaway from King's Cross? Were you intrigued by what they'd done? Did you think they'd done a good job?
We have done a good job because okay, our
Allied and Morris were heavily involved. I know.
We are the master planners with another practice, Dimitri Porfirio's associate as well. So it has been a long journey. We have been involved in that project for 17 years. And all those start to become like a place, it's a real place. It's still not finished. It's 70% completed. So it's a place that is still in its infancy, really, taking its first baby steps. But in a sense, going back to what Jared was saying, I think that a great deal of master plan was about the calibration of the spaces, and that was a sort of a very carefully composed sequence. So you're starting in the nearest station, it's very wide, and then you go into these tighter areas in St. Pancras Square, and you are between alleys, and then you go into Granary Square that is wide again, and you have the listed building of the Granary Building, and then you go to a park. And all that, in a sense, is describing how people will experience the place, that is basically walking through it. And the buildings are a background to public life of different nature, one in relation to transport, one in relation to work, one in relation to study, one in relation to living.
And Alfredo, tell me, so as the master planner of the area, what were the limitations put in place? Because anybody left to their own devices, they will come up with a plan that maybe doesn't serve everyone's needs. So was there a good tension there between the community that was there, between the city demanding certain things that happened? What's the lineup of pressures and pulls and pushes that make for a good private project like that?
Well, I must say that we were extremely lucky of working with an enlightened client. Arjun is an extraordinary developer that had a very clear vision of what they wanted to do. At the beginning of the project, there was this seminar that then the product of that seminar was Principles for a Human City. That was, in a sense, the vision that was going to guide the whole of the process. And in particular, Roger Madeline, who was leading the project for Arjun, basically did a huge effort, also in consultation terms, to talk to anyone that had a stake on the project. But equally, in the public sector, there was an incredibly strong planning team led by Peter Bishop that also was one of the champions of the project. So, and it was this, this is lucky, and we were very incredibly fortunate, both in the private sector and the public sector, were a series of individuals that have clear vision and commitment to the project to deliver a great place for London. Without that, it's very difficult to have a good place.
The sense that you go there in the day-to-day life, it feels very mixed and open, but the complicated thing for any developer is delivering genuinely affordable housing for a large community of people. And in the end, a developer needs its return on its investment, and the percentage of what's affordable and non-affordable will never match the needs of the local community who would like it all to be properly affordable housing. But again, when you looked at, did you think that there was a fair mix of residential for all types of people that you saw there?
When we were at King's Cross, I think it was more about how can the Summerstone neighborhood around, how come they weren't more integrated into this big area, really. I couldn't understand that because we could also see that there were barriers, such as a big building, sort of a barrier into this place. But when we looked at the Olympic and the Olympic legacy, that was planned from the beginning to be a residential area and also with affordable housing. So that wasn't so obvious as it was, I would say, around King's Cross. So I think it's also how can the neighborhood be more involved and the context around this kind of big developments to be more engaged with the community who already lives there. There will be, of course, working opportunities. Some people will go there and there will be schools, public schools, and all other kind of cultural institutions that would really start to make that good mix. But at the end of the day, it's about affordability and how much money do you have and can you live here? So, and you have different kinds of public housing and affordability. And I think that has to be high up on the agenda always to have this mixed use, mixed income, which is really the kind of city you want to live in.
And just again for listeners around the world, Somerstown is an abutting neighbourhood, a lot of public housing. It was an area that was much damaged after the Second World War, a lot of rebuilding in the post-war period, a much poorer area than many of the places that surround it. So it runs all the way up to Regent's Park, where again, you have this kind of big inset of wealth, but an interesting area. What can you do in those situations, Jared? How do you bring a community that there's this amazing Cold Drop Yards, this retail space, and you know, let's be honest, you're not going to go there unless you're earning a certain amount of money. It's not aimed at everybody. Is that the job of the developer? Because again, in the end, the developer has to make some money, don't they?
Yeah, it's a great question for me. I feel like the role of design in that case is to be a democratizing agent, right? Which is, it shouldn't be too precious. The developer has to make a return. That's absolutely clear. Otherwise, we'd have nothing to talk about because they would not be able to finance the project. You can't satisfy all of the challenges of the surrounding community in any one given project. And so time really is valuable, which is, can you make people feel welcome and comfortable? Can you provide opportunities for the local community to engage? And can you provide resources for them that are things that are missing from their own communities in order to welcome them in? What are the gestures? You know, how do we go about communicating? I think one of the things that people raised as one of the challenges, candidly, of the project was signage and wayfinding to a way, which are, what are the clear boundaries about when signage should stop? And what is the perspective of the signage? Like, all of the signage that was developed for King's Cross is internally focused. Like, this is how you get to this place in King's Cross. But there was precious few instances of signage which was focused on how do you get to this place in the local community.
Well, that was Monica von Schmalensee, Jared Della Valle, and Alfredo Caraballo. You heard about the impact the development of King's Cross has had in London, and how indeed it's been received by the public. Well, to better understand this, we dispatched Monocle's very own Nick Manise on a tour of King's Cross with the Van Allen International Council. He went on a mission to find out what it is that made this public-private partnership work.
A group of leading architects and urban designers are gathered at New London Architecture, where Peter Murray, the centre's executive director, is providing some background on London's architecture and planning history. He's explaining the political and commercial context surrounding the redevelopment of King's Cross before the group, the Van Allen International Council, head to the site to explore it in person. In simple terms, the development has been made possible thanks to Section 106 of the British Government's Town and Country Planning Act and the London Plan, an overall strategic document to guide the growth of the city. Here's Peter addressing the group and explaining more.
You'll hear Section 106 talked about quite a lot in the development, which is basically the tax which is placed on developers to deliver new developments, and generally that takes the form, or the most significant form it takes is in providing affordable homes, but it can also be other public goods that the planning authority requires. The London Plan is called Opportunity Areas, and we can see them here. Earl's Court, which is a bit sluggish at the moment for political reasons. At White City over here, where the BBC Centre is, that's another opportunity area that's going to break guns at the moment. And you will go to King's Cross, which is generally seen as the best piece of mixed use and new planning in the city, and probably in Europe.
With the University of Arts London, bustling squares and plazas, exciting job opportunities, and thousands of new and affordable homes, thanks to Section 106, all beautifully contained within the 8 million square foot site, it's easy to see why it's thought of so highly. The bulk of the work has been managed and delivered by British developers Argent, and in 2016, when the British government sold its stake in the land, they became one of the two private companies who now wholly own the site. It's their responsibility to deliver the planned public assets and spaces. It's fair to assume these are in safe hands. Other than a slight reduction to the initial affordable housing target, Argents have otherwise delivered on community promises, overseeing the creation of community sporting facilities and schools. Their involvement stretches back to the project's inception in 2000. the same year they appointed Allies & Morrison, a British architecture firm, to master plan the site. Over the course of the past 15 years, the firm have overseen King's Cross's transformation from an industrial railway yard to a lively neighbourhood. Bob Allies, one of the practice's founding partners, is on site to meet Van Allen's International Council. He greets them at Granary Square, the redevelopment's flagship public space. It's midday on a Wednesday and the square is already packed with people. There are children in bathing suits playing in the plaza's water fountains. They're watched by their yummy mummy chaperones who sit on granite benches juggling prams and nappy bags. Nearby, business people in chinos and sneakers line up for lunch and food trucks serving slow-smoked pastrami sandwiches, while students from Central St. Martin's lazily make their way toward the university's new home in the restored Granary building. The public life on show is a marker of the successful redevelopment, something Bob is keen to attribute to Argent's work.
One of the really brilliant things they did, and I can't stress enough that, you know, as the urban designer or the architect doing a master plan, that's a tiny component of what makes these projects a success. A huge amount is the judgments being made by the client, by the developer.
Crossing the square, Bob leads the International Council into the foyer of the building, a cavernous structure that seamlessly blends the Victorian-era granary and railway sheds with new concrete and glass walls. The space is bustling. It's not only filled with students, but business people cutting through and tourists in sensible walking shoes. We stop partway down the foyer at the official entry to the university.
These barriers are, if you like, the beginning of the private domain of the college. But that means that this space is interestingly ambiguous because it's not quite public, not quite private. And normally there are table tennis tables and things here and people are just using it. And then the college sometimes, as they're doing now, grows into it to put on shows and things happen here. So it's an interesting outcome that these sorts of spaces have this flexibility in the end, the way they were used. We really had no idea. I mean, it could have been anything. It could have been given over to a private occupier. So it was just fantastically helpful. And the fact that the art college came here immediately changed the whole atmosphere of the place. Suddenly there were 5,000 students coming up and down every day from the station using the site. And so it immediately gave the place life very early on in the project.
Central St. Martin's has not only given the development life, but also a public and civic nucleus. Its entry hall and exhibition foyer are places where you don't have to pay to participate in public life. They're social destinations that people can dwell in and enjoy for free. This is an important move in ensuring that not only the streets of the private development are open and engaging for the public, but also some of the buildings too. Other than Granary Square and Central St. Martin's, the site is home to smaller green spaces and plazas, as well as a host of pared-back, mixed-use and residential buildings. And whilst the simplicity of the built form has certainly had some critics, renowned architect Peter Cook, Zaha Hadid's mentor, called them boring and reminiscent of old biscuits. There's something refreshing about them playing second fiddle to the streets that surround them. Bob explains that the buildings aim to reinforce the urban identity of the public spaces they face onto. They're packed closely together, producing an atmosphere that few new developments have. The result? Streets and plazas that actually live up to the hype of their architectural drawings, which showed children playing and people jogging and laying in the sun. Once we'd wrapped up our tour of the redevelopment site, I sat down with Bob to find out more about how they made the project work.
We were master planners for King's Cross, working with Dimitri Porfirios, a project which has taken something like 20 years next year, to take from the initial design stages through to what I suppose is now something like 70% complete.
We're interested in your role and your master planning role. What advantage did you have as private practitioners?
Well, one of the curiosities of urbanism in Britain over the last 20 years or so has been that the bringing forward of these large-scale regeneration projects in cities has fallen principally to the private sector, and the private sector have assembled the land and come forward with proposals and then sought the approval of the local authority planners, the people who live nearby, the London government, the mayor, the GLA. And through that process, they obviously don't have in-house architects, so they are then employing people like us to work on these projects. So for good or for bad, I think it's become driven by the private sector or the public sector. But what I think that has meant is that there is, at its best within the private sector, there is a a sensibility or a judgment about what is might be required to make successful places.
And you sort of touched on your role working with the developer. How did you balance their interests and private interests with the interests of the city and public interests?
I think the thing probably that is always most important for us is a notion of continuity, really. So we think good cities are made out of continuous fabric. So that's the starting point. We think that there should be continuity between all parts of the city so that there should be very good connections, so that somewhere like this is not a separate estate but is completely knitted into the rest of the city, both in terms of the way it locks into the existing road structure, the way it locks into the canal and the towpath, in the way that the buildings don't just face inwards towards the centre, they face outwards towards the rest of the city. And I suppose the third aspect of continuity, important, King's Cross maybe in particular, is a sense of continuity over time. In other words, that sense in which you can take a piece of the city, which actually has huge historical significance here, of course, you can let it evolve into a kind of future life, but at the same time, you can preserve the significance of the things that you've inherited from the past, so that, you know, it's new, but it's also, if you like, old as well, because all those things are still there, those things have made it special.
And then I guess just to round out, and this is going to be a very broad question, but, you know, you've got 20 years experience on this site. What are the key lessons you've learned, or is there anything that stands out in particular that you would apply when you're working on similar projects?
I think probably we are most impressed, and I say we're most impressed because in a sense it wasn't us who did this, it was the developer who did it. We're most impressed by their determination to enrich the mix of uses that go on the site. There's a tendency with master plans, almost an irresistible tendency, that you feel you have to be constrained by the uses which you know are viable and plausible. But of course, in the end, what's making this work well as a piece of city is that there's an enormous diversity of different things going on here, from schools to cinemas to shops to theatres to museums, universities. And that does just change the atmosphere. I mean, in some ways it makes it more normal, you might say, just more like a normal piece of city. Cities at their best, I think, do have that quality.
A report there by Monocle's Nick Manise. So it's important for regular citizens like you and me to be given access to this debate between architects, planners and developers, and to hear the demands and pressures that both unite and pull them apart. Even the most ambitious metropolises in the end cannot afford to fund everything from city coffers. They need partnerships with the private sector. But people are getting smarter, and the good thing is that people are demanding that the debate is opened up. And it seems unlikely that we would get another Hudson Yards. But actually, that's only if we continue to pull this conversation into the open and add more moments of scrutiny where you and me can have our say. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. But do make sure you tune in next week, because we're going to pick up the conversation with Monica, Jared and Alfredo as we head off on another part of the tour with the International Council of the Van Allen Institute. Today's show, well, this one was produced by Carlotta Ribello, it was researched by Nick Manise, and it was edited, of course, by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Dusty Springfield with In Private. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.